Hello, Canucks fans. We're back. It's episode 70 of the Canucks Speakeasy Podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Doug.
And Doug, I'd say this is normally when we get into the game flight, but I don't remember the last time the Canucks have played a game. It's been a long time.
Yeah, we've missed the last two or three weeks, and not a game has been played. Obviously, there was a massive outbreak of the COVID variety, unfortunately. And today's obviously, trade deadline day as well. So there's definitely quite a bit of Canucks news for us to talk about, but it won't be our usual format this week, will it?
No, this is going to be kind of getting back in the groove. And, we didn't record the last couple of weeks because, it's not really much fun just to talk about COVID. And so we just kind of decided to pause until things were relevant. A couple of newsworthy things broke, but trade deadline day today, there's always tons of stuff to talk about around the league and even with the Canucks. Like, I was expecting nothing today, and we had three trades made.
Yeah, I was the same. I was expecting going into this deadline and the Canucks not making a move whatsoever. I was hopeful, and they did, that the Canucks would be able to get a late round pick for a guy like Jordy Benn. But outside of that, I didn't see the Canucks making any more deals today, and they actually made two more on top of that Jordy Benn deal. One that I think might have rubbed a lot of Canucks fans the wrong way, myself included. And another one that might be a little bit of a hedge scratcher, but is also, maybe a reclamation project, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. So let's just jump into things with the trade deadline. First of all, you can follow myself. I'm at Pete_Gass, and the podcast is at Canucks Speak.
You can give me a follow on Twitter at Doug Venn. And as always, Pete and I are putting together this ever-growing outro playlist on Spotify. It's the Canucks Speakeasy outro playlist on Spotify. Make sure you give that a follow. Give that a listen. It'll help you get through your work week. It'll help you get through today's trade deadline day disaster, if that's the angle you're going to take. But regardless, there's just some really cool, funky jams, and there'll be another one added today.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot then, Doug, right away. Was today a trade deadline disaster day for you?
I wouldn't say it was a disaster, but I have a lot of questions, and I definitely don't like the Gaudette trade. I'm not saying that Gaudette was great this year. He had been struggling. I do think that his shooting percentage was unreasonably bad. Like, he definitely had some bad puck luck this year. I don't think he's as bad as his shooting percentage dictated. My issue is, and again, time after time, this management group seems to sell low on players. I don't understand why trading Gaudette now makes a difference. I don't understand, nothing against the Highmore, the kid we're getting back from Chicago, but it doesn't make sense to me. I know he's got, some bottom six upside. I know a lot of people are trying to liken him to a Tyler Motte. He plays with energy. He's quick on the puck. He's got speed, but I still don't think selling on an asset low like the Canucks did with Gaudette today was the right move. I know there's speculation, and I don't think any of this is true, but there's some speculation, and some media members have, again, there's conflicting reports, but one media member said that there's absolutely no merit to some reports that the Canucks may have traded Gaudette because he was patient zero for their COVID outbreak. But then another media member said that he heard the exact opposite and that a lot of players were angry at Gaudette and that kind of forced management's hand to trade him now. I don't buy that. I just think it was a mistake to sell low on a guy. And I time and time again, I just look at the Canucks management and how they continuously sell low on players. I mean, I remember it was about a year and a half ago, there was rumors that the Canucks could have traded Louis Erickson and the remainder of his contract if they added a player like Adam Gaudette or Brogan fucking Rafferty, which the Canucks didn't want to trade. So again, I'm just a little confused why we're selling low. This also reminds me, and I'll admit, Pete, I'm going on a bit of a rant here. I've got a little bit of PTSD, but this also reminds me of Gillis when he fucking sold low on Cody Hodgson. At that time, it did not make sense to me. Cody Hodgson was your legitimate third-line center heading into a playoffs. You wanted to try to get back to that form you had in 2011. And instead, they traded him for a winger like Zach Kassian, who I've always thought was a major disappointment. And again, they were selling low on Cody Hodgson, and there were rumors about him wanting to play up the lineup. And I know Jim Benning today said, oh, Adam Gaudette wanted to play up the lineup. There's no way Adam Gaudette, if he wanted to continue to play center, thought he could usurp Bo Horvat or Elias Pettersson in the center ice position, or even JT Miller for that example. So it doesn't make sense to me. Why do you sell low on your assets like this?
Well, the Cody Hodgson thing, just going back to that, that was something that this reminded me of draft day as well. In the end of it, Zach Kassian's turned out to be the better player out of the two in that trade. So that's something
he's had a better, longer career, but 100%. Cody Hodgson's highs were a lot higher than Zach Kassian, in my opinion. And then what did Gillis do? He literally traded Cody Hodgson for Zach Kassian, and then he thought he could fill his third line center position with the corpse of Sammy Paulson. You know, Sammy Paulson was like literally a corpse when the Canucks traded for him, pardon me. I'm fired up today, Pete. It's been a couple of weeks, and I always try to be level-headed, but it doesn't make sense, man. Just like the Cody Hodgson trade, the timing of this doesn't make sense. You can't tell me the Canucks could have got more for Adam Gaudette in the offseason or at the draft table than they did for today.
Thing is, I'm not crazy about this trade at first, but I am willing to see what we have in Matthew Highmore. One thing that does jump out at me, Highmore had a good playoffs last year, and Gaudette didn't do much in the playoffs last year. So there is something to be said for recent play, and Highmore putting up 3 goals in 9 games when Gaudette had no points in 10 games is something that's worth paying attention to. I'm not crazy about the trade either. I'm going to wait and see just exactly what Highmore brings to the team. And I guess he's got a quarantine, so we probably won't get to see him right away here. But I do think that there's more to this story than we know, because the timing is strange. Maybe, and again, I'm just hypothesizing here, maybe Gaudette said that he was not going to sign any sort of contract when he was RFA status and he was going to hold out. And that would force the Canucks' hand then anyways. And it would also complicate things because they would have had to figure out what to do with him with Seattle coming up. So this kind of makes the move there. Still, I think you possibly could have gotten more than Highmore, but I don't know. I don't know what was out there. Maybe I think there's more to this. I don't know if anything with the players and all that is true or not. I'm not sure if I buy into that, or that they're blaming Gaudette as being patient zero, because, I mean, we don't really know if he was, and there's no truth to that, and it's just easy to jump on him. But I will say, and I've learned this from the Thomas Vanek trade, is that I'm not going to shit on the return until I actually see what we got, because we got Tyler Mott in that deal, and at the time everyone wanted a draft pick, and I wonder if we gotten a second or a third for Gaudette, would people have been any happier? Is it just the thought that we traded Gaudette now? And for me, Gaudette wasn't doing a lot this year. I don't know where Gaudette really did fit in on this team, and I'm not sure I know where Highmore fits in on this team either. But for me, Gaudette wasn't doing enough to be in the top 9 wing. He certainly couldn't play on the fourth role, and there wasn't really any room at center. So he could have maybe been a 3C next year. But I will say, initially, I'm not a fan of this trade, but I want to see the player that we get back before I make any final decisions on it.
Yeah, but if you could think back to the Thomas Vanek trade, he was a pending UFA who was 34 years old that the Canucks probably weren't going to re-sign. So I understand, you know, even the fact that we didn't get a draft pick and we got a guy like Tyler Mott who has panned out for the Canucks, that made sense in the grand scheme of things, because you are getting younger, you're getting faster, and you're using one of these assets that you signed as a free agent in the offseason to flip for a better, younger player to help your team. Gaudette is younger than Highmore by a couple of years. He had a very good productive year last year. I believe he finished the season with 12 goals and 21 assists for 33 points. Gaudette, you know, yes, he struggled this year, and yes, he did find himself stapled to the pine for a lot of the playoff run last year. But I still think he was trying to find his game. Coming into this year's training camp, there was talks about he had some undiagnosed dietary issue, which wasn't allowing him to keep weight on, and he figured that out this year. I definitely, and again, I'm not saying that Gaudette's going to, you know, be the next Cam Neely, and the Canucks are going to majorly regret trading him for Highmore. I just think that as an asset management perspective, you sold extremely low on this guy. And I don't think, the production that you got out of Gaudette last season, it's somewhere between what you got from last season to this season, right? I don't think he's as bad as he's been this year. And I don't necessarily think he can be as productive as he was last year. But again, you know, the guy we traded for is, I believe, 2 years older. He was an overager, unsigned college free agent who the Canucks apparently did have interest in 4 years ago, and he chose to sign with the Blackhawks over the Canucks and whatever other teams had shown interest in him. I just, again, from a pure asset management situation, I think it's a terrible move, personally. I mean, now, I think a guy like Vertanen, if it was Vertanen you were switching in this spot, I might have been able to swallow that pill a little bit more, because I haven't really seen any progression in Vertanen's game long term. But obviously the problem with Vertanen and trying to trade him is that the Canucks backloaded his 2 year qualifying offer, and no team wants to pick up, I believe it's the $3.2 million he's owed next year. And that's why the Danton Heinen trade fell through for the Canucks. Apparently, obviously, the Canucks and the Ducks a couple months ago, there was rumors and speculation that the deal was trying to be hammered out, but the Canucks didn't want to retain any salary on Vertanen's contract, and that's why that deal fell through, because they backloaded it. And again, I don't know if that's Benning's issue or if that's ownership's issue for backloading those salaries so they can theoretically have more money coming in with gate revenue next year, where this year they're trying to cheap out on salaries a little bit because there's no gate revenue.
I mean, Vertanen, I think he's a tough guy to move. I wouldn't be surprised if he got bought out, but I think that's kind of a tough situation now for the Canucks to be in, to sign a guy for 2 years and then buy him out with 1 year left. I think that would rub a lot of people the wrong way, but he's a guy who I've said, I don't see any way you can justify qualifying him if you do keep him around for next year. I don't see how you can justify the price tag to qualify him after that. And look, I'm not crazy about the Gaudette deal, but I believe there is more to it than what we know, because it did kind of come out of the blue. I don't know exactly what the Canucks see in Highmore. I do know that he's got a nice price tag for next year, so he's going to fit well into this cap situation. But again, I'm going to reserve judgment until I actually see what this guy can bring to the table. The Canucks have a bevy now of these kind of bottom six forwards, and I'm kind of curious to see how this is all going to pan out. We'll get games out of Highmore, I guess, if he's traded today. We probably won't see him until, I guess, next Tuesday, which would be, I guess, the 20th or so at the earliest. But it's a weird one. I do think, though, that we don't know everything with it. It's funny that, like, when you're trading a guy like Gaudette as well, like, he's a guy who we've hyped up in this system for so long. He wins a Hobie Baker, and there's always that feeling too. And someone asked me today, is like, overvalue Adam Gaudette as a player? And I'm like, I'm not sure, because I still don't know what Adam Gaudette as a player is. I've always got this weird thing with Hobie Baker winners. I know we had two of them on the team for a brief period there, but I'm not quite sure what Adam Gaudette's ceiling really is. I originally thought he could be like a 20 goal, 25 assists forward. If so, then Chicago's going to win that trade, because I don't know if Highmore's ceiling is that high. But if Highmore can fill in and do some meaningful bottom 6 minutes on a cheap salary and fill his role, then, you know, that's going to be good too. But I want to see how this plays out. Initially, though, I didn't like this trade either, but I'm preaching patience with myself here, because I got to see where things go from here. And remember as well, Chicago is a way of making projects really good. You know, they've done it with Strome. They've done it with just other guys that they've plugged in on the wings. So I wouldn't be surprised if they put Gaudette into a top six role right away here, just to kind of see what they got.
Do you think this might set up the Canucks to go with Horvat, Miller, and Pettersson as your 1-2-3? Like, not saying it would be necessarily in that order, but having Horvat, Miller, and Pettersson as the three C's heading into next year, right?
This is something that I've wanted. I've wanted them to do this, but the problem is right now, of course, is they don't have the wingers to do that. And you know, we're going to talk about Pearson and Podkolzin a little bit more later on, but with those guys and you get Brock in there as well, is there enough in the top six with Höglander as well to stretch those guys across three lines? Right now, I'd say no, but that's, I think, ultimately what the team would like, and that's what I would like, is if you could roll those three centers down the middle, I think you're going to be a much more competitive team, but you got to put the wingers around them to do that, and clearly they thought that Adam Gaudette was not going to be a third-line winger on this team long-term.
Yeah, I mean, again, I never like when... And I feel like the Canucks have been really bad at this for a few, you know, going back to the Gillis eras, just selling low-owned players. I felt Gillis, for whatever reason, even though he was really productive, sold low on Cody Hodgson because Cody wanted to play up the lineup, and apparently there were some issues with his dad. It's like, dude, you're the general manager of an NHL team. The kid has no leverage over you. You're trying to go back and, you know, make a playoff run. What are you doing? And today, I thought it was the same thing. I mean, you can't tell me there was... Throughout the entire year, we had heard, you know, speculation that a lot of teams had been calling the Canucks about Adam Gaudette. There was a report, I want to say back in January, that the Predators were interested in Gaudette and his name was coming up with Nashville. And you're telling me that, and again, no offense to Highmore, you know, again, you know, I'm sure he's going to be a decent player, but you're telling me that the Canucks, that's the best they could come up with for this trade? It doesn't make sense. And then when you look into Highmore, and I think it was Thomas Drantz reported, like, the guy doesn't even play penalty, PK, you know what I mean? Like, he's not even a penalty killer. So, you know, what is he? He's just literally a fourth line guy. At least some of the bottom six guys that the Canucks have overpaid for over the past few years, they can at least kill penalties for you. And it doesn't sound like Highmore's much of a penalty killer. He's definitely not a center. You know, he's only taken four faceoffs, I think, in, you know, his career or something like that, or at least four faceoffs this year. So yeah, it's just a little bit disappointing. I know he had a strong showing for Chicago and the bubble last year, which is great. But yeah, for me, I just, I don't know. It was just a weird trade. And again, even if the Canucks would have got a pick back, like let's say they would have got a fourth round pick out, squeezed a fourth round pick out of Chicago for this deal, I think I could have swallowed it a little bit better. But straight up for Highmore, it just doesn't make sense to me. And this is the other thing that I don't understand is, like, I look at Benning sometimes with some of the deals he makes, and it looks like he's overpaying. But he never gets, like, sure, the Schmidt deal, he did get a deal, but he was also helping a rival out by giving them cap relief so they could go sign a better defenseman in Petrangelo. But he seems to always overpay for trades, always overpay when he re-signs players or signs free agents. It just, you know, he just, and it you think, okay, you know what, I'll scratch your back this time, you know what, I'll give you that pick. Even with the Bowie trade, which we'll get into here, you know, he threw in a pick with that trade as well. I was like, why? I don't know. It just, yeah.
Well, the Canucks traded a pick, but they got a player and a pick. So
yeah, I guess that's true.
It's a slight downgrade on that trade, going from a fourth rounder to a fifth rounder, but you get you're taking a chance on a right-hand defenseman. I like that trade. Madison Bowie's a guy that we've talked about before. I always got a thing with Kelowna Rockets defenseman. They've got a good program there, and former World Junior guy, former first rounder. But this is his fourth organization now, I believe, already. So he's definitely a project. He could go kind of the ilk of a Derek Pouliot. That's, I think, kind of the worst-case scenario for him, or he could actually turn into something. It's interesting. That was the Canucks' second trade with the Blackhawks, so I think they had that one just waiting for someone to take Jordy Benn. And once Jordy Benn got taken, that trade call was made official as well. With those two defenseman moves, Jordy Benn for six, that seems kind of like what we could expect for that. It's good. No one really seems too upset about that. It's so funny that we have a fan base that gets real excited about a sixth round pick, but that's the passionate Canucks fans that we have out there. And this is a weird draft too. And from everything that, you know, I've long said that I'd rather acquire 2022 picks than 2021. And recently I've had a little bit of a shift in thought. I'm not quite as strict on that, but I do believe that if you have a good scouting department, there's going to be some diamonds in the rough in the later rounds. So just get picks wherever and you know, take a pick for Jordy Benn. The Bowie trade, again, I think that's a decent low-risk trade. I like that. But certainly the talking point is Adam Gaudette and just the similarities. You hear Cody Hodgson and Tyler Motte's names tied into this story all the time. Jared McCann is another guy who I think we might have sold low on when we did. And
yeah,
again, you heard that there may have been issues with him as well in the past. And look, I don't know if there was issues, but something is there that I think there's something more to it. We may never know it, but I do believe that with Seattle coming in and with him being an RFA, I think there was something there where it was either going to be difficult to get him signed or he wasn't going to sign. And again, I'm just speculating, but it's the only way that things like this can make sense, because otherwise I don't quite understand what this trade is all about.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you want to try to put a positive spin on it, I guess you could say that the Canucks decided that they are going to put a keeper spot for a guy like Cole Lind over Adam Gaudette. So instead of potentially losing Gaudette for nothing by either not qualifying him in the offseason or leaving him unprotected for the Kraken to claim, they trade him, they get an asset back, and now they can protect Cole Lind. I mean, that's kind of how I'm looking at it come the expansion draft. Whether or not that's going to happen, who knows? But that's sort of, I guess, a positive spin you can put on it. Yeah, the Jordy Benn trade, I think that's fair. I mean, you look at what some of the other defensemen that are of his ilk went for today. I think Erik Gustafsson went for a seventh-round pick. Erik Gudbranson went for a seventh-round pick. So I was listening to Sakaris and Price's new show on my way home from work, and Sakaris reported that he had heard the Canucks had been asking for a fifth-round pick for Benn, and I think at the last minute they settled for a sixth-round pick. And I think, like you said, they probably had the Bowie trade in their pocket, and they needed to move another defenseman out to make that trade work. Look, the Bowie situation, they could have signed him in the offseason as a free agent, so to give up a pick to get him now seems a little bit counterproductive. That being said, you know, he is a reclamation project. For whatever reason, he did have a very strong game. He was part of Draisaitl's team when he was on the Rockets, but his game just hasn't been able to translate to the NHL. He is a right shot defenseman, which the Canucks do need. So hopefully, you know, the Canucks can get something out of him. But, you know, last year he was in Detroit, and I know he struggled and he found himself on the bench, and Detroit was, you know, one of the bottom feeders last year. And if he can't play for that team, that's a little bit concerning. Chicago, which I think they've definitely overachieved this year. They've come down to earth a little bit since the beginning of the year. That's another team that isn't that depth, doesn't have that much depth on the back end, and he was struggling to find minutes there. But who knows? Like I said, I think if he's put in the right position and he's not counted on to play, you know, big, hard minutes against tough competition, he could be a good bottom pairing right shot guy. We'll see. It also, I think, gives the Canucks a little bit of insurance with Travis Hamonic, who's a pending UFA this year, and whether or not they think they can re-sign him. And I think Hamonic has played a lot better since coming back from that injury. But, you know, this gives him a little bit of insurance on the right side, because right now in the Canucks prospect pool, they don't really have too many prospects on the right side. I think Jet Wu, who most people don't think is going to be ready to make the jump to the NHL next year, outside of Jet Wu, like, I can't think of any other young defensive prospects on the right side they have. The left side, they're pretty stacked, obviously. They got Rathbone, they got Ulevi, obviously Quinn Hughes. Edler is going to be leaving, so who knows if they resign him. But yeah, overall, the first trade was disappointing, I think, but I think the other two trades, the Jordy Benn trade, it's definitely a win for me, and I can get behind the thought process behind the Bowie trade. This also gives them a little bit of flexibility with the pending expansion draft coming up, because now I guess they can protect Myers because they didn't have enough guys to protect, apparently. So whether or not they protect Myers, who knows? I mean, they kind of got a free spot. Thomas Drantz also hinted that this gives him a little bit of flexibility with something else. I didn't see what his elaboration was there. I think he's maybe trying to insinuate that they can maybe take advantage of a team that doesn't have that flexibility. I mean, we saw Carolina trade Hayden Fleury today for, I know he hadn't been struggling as well, but you know, they didn't really get a solid return for him, but that frees up a spot on their defense. Now they don't have to worry about as much heading into the expansion draft.
One thing that the Bowie trade does, he's signed for next year as well, so he's under contract through 2022, but it does make the Canucks meet the requirements, because they need to have two defensemen, I believe it is, who've played a minimum amount of the 27 games, but they also have to have a guy who's under contract available. So the Canucks wouldn't have had that, but what this now allows them to do is if they wanted to protect him, they could. Or if they wanted to protect Myers, they could. I don't think they're going to protect either one of them, and they're still going to hopefully weaponize that third defenseman spot. I think Schmidt and Yolevi are the only two that they're going to protect right now, but the Canucks this offseason, it really should be a priority of going to teams that have too many defensemen and seeing if they can grab one of those, because there's a few teams out there who are set to lose a good defenseman for nothing to Seattle.
What would the ramifications have been if the Canucks didn't have enough guys to protect? Do you know, like, you know, would there have been any, like, obviously they're not going to have to be forced to protect a guy like Hughes because he's still ineligible. But do you know what the ramifications would have been if they didn't have enough players on the defensive end to protect?
I mean, if they could have, I think there's a way where they could have maybe taken more forwards than defensemen. I think it's the other way around. You do four forwards and four defensemen. I don't think there's anything going the other way. It could have just been loss of picks, a fine by the league. I don't know. I think the teams have basically been told that this is what you have to do by the end of the season to be compliant for Seattle. So I think it's just, that's just something that they have to do.
Yeah. And you know what? I hope the Canucks do take advantage of the teams that are, you know, looking to lose a player for nothing with the pending expansion draft. But this management group just doesn't seem to have the foresight to do stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, I wish I could give them the credit, but they just don't. Like, they just haven't had that long-term planning where it's like, yes, we're going to take advantage of this. We're going to weaponize our cap space. We're going to, you know, try to sign UFAs and then flip them at the deadline. Like, how many pending UFAs have the Canucks had heading into a trade deadline in the Jim Benning era that they haven't been able to trade for an asset? You know, I think of the Ryan Miller, the final year of his contract, the Canucks didn't trade him when there were a lot of teams asking about Miller. Obviously the Dan Hamhuis thing, and there's a lot more at play, I think, with the Dan Hamhuis thing than I think any of us really know, because obviously the Dallas Star owner and the Canuck owner have a bit of a history together. Today, Brandon Sutter, you know, and I know Benning had said he didn't want to ask players who were going through the COVID protocol any of that stuff, but Brandon Sutter is another pending UFA, and it's like, oh, what, are we just going to re-sign Sutter? I don't know. I'm a little frustrated today, Pete. I don't know if you can tell.
I think a lot of Canucks fans, though, it's easy to forget that we're not the only team that has UFAs every year. So, like, let's take the Detroit Red Wings just as an example. The Detroit Red Wings, one of the few teams in the league that are below the Canucks in points right now. But they have six UFAs this year that are coming up, and they didn't move them. And some of those guys, like, you think there's fans in Detroit are like, why did we not trade Darren Helm or Valtteri Filppula? Or geez, I don't know. You got Mark Stahl is another guy. Like, I know that his contract's a bit high, but it's hard to move every single UFA that you have. And the Canucks did move one, and they moved an RFA, which we've already talked about. But they did get one out of there, which, again, is one more than I thought they would. I thought with COVID and everything else this year, I was expecting nothing to really happen. So to get the three trades, I'm okay with that. But, yeah, a lot of teams, though, there are players out there. Every team that's below the Canucks has UFAs that they weren't able to move. Like, even Buffalo, they have a couple of cheap guys like Tobias Ryder and Riley Sheehan. They weren't able to move either of those guys out. But It's tough to move guys in the cap era, especially when you're a team with COVID and you have a border that is also closed. That makes things a little bit more difficult, a little less so if the Canucks are trying to receive players back. But I understand. I mean, the Canucks have, this group has not thought outside the box. And I really liked seeing the three-way trades that were happening. I thought that was a really cool way of making salary move. And I think we're going to see more of that in the future. Another way that teams can weaponize their cap space to bring in a pick or a prospect for not really doing much, just kind of being that third party of the, on the trade. But the Canucks don't think outside the box. And this offseason, they have to think outside the box. This is a huge offseason for the Canucks. They're going to have to figure out, obviously, they got the two big contracts that they're going to sign. And then they got to figure out what they're going to do with to fill out the roster and what they're going to do about the blue line and what they're going to do to increase the forward core. Because the team needs a lot of improvements around the board, and they are going to be losing players. So for me, this offseason really requires creative thinking. And it doesn't get any easier. The year after that, you've got the Brock Besser situation. He's RFA. You've got Jake Virtanen and trying to decide what to do there. It doesn't get easier, and they need to think outside the box. So that for me, that's something that I think we need to keep an eye on. What about around the league? What other trades did you like? What ones jumped out at you?
Well, you mentioned the fact that, you know, the Red Wings had six or seven UFAs and they didn't trade any of them, but all can be forgiven when you're able to flip Anthony Mantha for a first, a second, and Jacob Varana. So I think even, you know, adding that additional first round pick, regardless of not being able to trade some of those pending UFAs, is still a giant win for the Detroit Red Wings and Steve Yzerman. So kudos to Yzerman for getting that haul out of Washington. I do think Washington is getting a solid player in Mantha. I know he struggled a bit this year, but last year he had a really good year. Boston paying what they paid to get Taylor Hall is interesting. It's also interesting that Boston's now had both Taylor and Tyler. Obviously, they had Sagan back in the day. They drafted him. They won the Stanley Cup, unfortunately, with him. And now they have just added Taylor Hall to their mix. I know there's a lot of people that have been crapping on Kevin Adams for not getting a proper return on the Taylor Hall situation, but it does sound like, as the reports came out today, that Taylor Hall really strapped them to the teams he would be willing to waive his no trade clause to, and it sounded like pretty much the only team he was willing to waive to was Boston. So that obviously made the return a lot more diminishing than I think what Buffalo was hoping for. And then obviously you see what the Leafs gave up to grab a guy like Nick Foligno. I think Nick Foligno is actually going to be a really good player for the Leafs for a playoff run. He's not a guy that's going to score, 20 goals, 30 goals for you at this point in his career, but he is a heavy, solid player that'll, play heavy minutes for you. And I think he could definitely help the Leafs in a long playoff run. Couple of the other trades that I thought were interesting, I don't know if they were great, but I thought, what Calgary was able to get out of Florida for Sam Bennett, I was like, holy cow, dude, they essentially got two second round picks for Sam Bennett. That was a little bit surprising. Now, I know a lot of people are saying, well, why couldn't the Canucks get something like that for Jake Virtanen? Again, Sam Bennett is RFA at the end of this year. Jake Virtanen is signed next year for $3.2 million. That's why the Canucks can't get a return like that for a guy like Jake. If they thought they could maybe get something like that for Jake, they would have had to have traded him last year before they qualified him, which they didn't. So that's kind of where that situation is. And then the other trade, again, and I hate to fucking give the Leafs credit, but the other trade I thought was a really sharp trade by the Leafs was the Leafs picking up David Rittich from Calgary for, I believe it was a third-round pick. That was a tidy bit of business by them as well.
I think the Leafs only have two or three picks in this next draft now. They've and then three or four in the one after that. I gotta double check that here, but three picks in next year and three the year after that right now.
What's interesting about those three picks this year and next year, both those picks have conditions on them. So there is a condition that the Leafs might only have two picks, I believe, heading into this year. And one of the conditions on one of the picks they have left for next year, there's a condition on that where they might only have two picks for next year's draft as well. But obviously the Leafs are all in, right?
Yeah, the Leafs are all in. I mean, they've got, I think, the best shot to come out of the North Division. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens after the North Division, though, when you have four teams that haven't played each other all year playing two rounds. I'm really looking forward to that as well, and I think the Leafs do have a pretty good chance, but I don't think they're in the clear. I think the Habs are going to give them a ton of trouble if they get the Habs. I think the Jets would give them a ton of I think any team. It's you never know, but it is the right move for Toronto to go all in right now. I think Columbus did a good job with getting a couple of first round picks back. Kukkolainen is another guy who thinks outside the box. I like that. I like Pittsburgh bringing in Jeff Carter just because Carter and Hextall is rubbing it in Philly's face, and that's going to be a fun little story line come the playoffs. Calgary moving Bennett, that was an interesting one. And yeah, about the same price tag as Taylor Hall. I thought that was interesting. And after that, nothing really jumped out at me. Again, I just liked the creativity with those two three-way deals and how that worked. I thought that was really clever. So I hope that we get to see a bit more of that in the future. I want to keep us moving here because we've kind of gone over on time with the trade deadline, but we could keep going on and on about that. But there's a lot of other things that have happened that we need to touch on. Let's start with the other big topic with the Canucks, with the whole COVID situation. And of course, you know, it's not really fun to report on COVID and everything else. I mean, entertainment and sports is kind of an escape. I know the sports world is still shrouded in COVID everything, right? You see masks and no crowds and stuff, and it's just the normal for 2020 and 2021. But no team in North American professional sports was hit as hard by COVID as the Canucks were. And that's just, you know, not something at the start of all this that I was expecting. I was sure it was going to be an American team, a Florida or a Texas team or something like that. But I wasn't expecting it to be Vancouver. So Canucks are, you know, again, you hear mixed reports about what's going on. It sounds like the team's getting better, and they're supposed to play hockey in 4 days, and they just got back onto the ice today. They have a super condensed schedule. They're going to go back to playing 19 games in 31 days after having 23 days off and having a virus run through the team. I mean, what are we going to expect out of these 19 games? I'm thinking if you win two of them, that's going to be a good stretch. I'm looking at this stretch myself as we'll hopefully get to see some of the kids. We'll hopefully get to see Cole Lind play, maybe some other guys as well. But man, this is going to be a tough slog for the team.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, you hope that all the players and their families and the coaching staff and, you know, even, you know, the behind the scenes staff, like the equipment guys, are safe and their families are safe and all that stuff. But yeah, just the way it's spread, and the thing I don't understand, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me, is that obviously Adam Gaudette had tested positive in the middle of a practice. They pulled him off the ice. And I guess at that time they weren't 100% sure whether or not he was actually positive, so they probably did a follow-up test with him immediately after he came off the ice just to make sure he didn't have a false positive. But why are players, and I get that they're being tested the day before and they're waiting for the results the next day, but again, like, why, like, there's got to be a better system set up for these players where you're not actually, you know, a day behind on testing, because that's essentially what happened, right? Gaudette technically was tested the day before. He got his positive test result the next day while he's already been on the ice, whether he's already been in the dressing room with a bunch of the other players, and then it just spread like wildfire. And even the fact that they didn't stop the practice that day is a little bit befuddling to me. But yeah, you know, obviously it went right through the Canucks organization. I think almost the entire Canucks organization ended up testing positive. Was it like 18 players, I believe, and I think two or three coaching staff and two players from the taxi squad.
It peaked at 21 players.
21 players plus coaches, right? Like, I believe, yeah. I kind of insinuated and never saw for sure that it was a positive case, but I saw on, I don't know if you heard the Jim Benning press conference today, But there was a question about whether or not how Travis Green's doing and, you know, if he's been better and all that stuff. So I would assume Green tested positive as well. Yeah, it was scary stuff, man. And then now the NHL is kind of like forcing these games in such a short window. I believe there's six back-to-back games in that 19-game stretch, which just seems ridiculous to me. You know, there's so many chances for the players to get injured, you know, in that compressed schedule. The games, you know, in theory aren't going to mean much. Like the Canucks have, I believe, the last three or four games of the season are against the Ottawa Senators. The chances of the Canucks and Ottawa still being in a playoff hunt during those four games is pretty much, you know, zilch to none. And yet, you know, we're forcing the Canucks and the players to play these games for no benefit outside of, you know, advertising dollars. And to me, it's a shame because I don't know that the NHL has made the right decision here. I understand, you know, they're trying to push for it, but it seems really, really misguided.
Well, the Canucks have 11 games after they play those four against the Sens, so it's not right at the end of the season. And I do understand why they're trying to do it with the keeping the integrity of having everyone play the same. And the players said they want to play it and they want to finish it. So I understand that competitive spirit. But, I mean, you start off with the toughest schedule in the league, with the most travel, with the most games played, and then you get 3.5 weeks off, and then you come back and you have the most condensed schedule with the most travel again. It's just a bizarre, bizarre schedule this year, which is, for me, I'm going to watch the games. I always do, and I'll cheer on the team. I don't expect a lot, but I'm hoping that we get to see some kids. And again, you know, I know a lot of Canucks fans down the stretch here, we're all going to start to look at the draft order and the odds and start researching the prospects more. I know that my focus is going to shift a little bit over to that in the next little while, but it's a strange situation. I'll be glad when this season's over. Hopefully they can get through it without injuries. I'm wondering if Petey comes back. I mean, there's no reason to rush him back. I wonder who we're going to see play. I think we're going to see some auditions for the club next year, which I always like to see, especially a guy like Cole Lind, who I'm really hoping to see, but maybe a guy like Lucas Jasik gets a look or someone as well. So, and that was the thing with Utica. It further complicated things. Of course, Utica wasn't playing either. So you've got a team down that hadn't played down there in 3 weeks who's finally back on the ice, and then you've got the situation up here. I mean, it's just been a nightmare of a year. I'll be glad to put this one in the rearview mirror and one day tell any youngsters sitting around me at a Canucks game about the horrible season of 2021.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, you know, I am hopefully looking forward to see Cole Lind make his NHL debut. Obviously, with Jordy Benn getting traded, that opens up playing time for a guy like Olli Juolevi, who had been in the press box for, what, the better half of 2 months. You know, we might get to see Jack Rathbone up here. I mean, with all these games and these back-to-back games the Canucks are playing, like, what about Mikey DiPietro? Like, you know what I mean? Maybe you throw him in for a game. You know, you put Holtby on the taxi squad. I don't think anyone's going to put a claim in for him with his contract heading into next year. Throw Holtby on the taxi squad for a couple of days and, you know, get Mikey DiPietro a couple of games, because the kid hasn't played in well over a year now, and it's probably too late in the season to be able to loan him to an AHL team in Canada or anything like that. So, you know, I would think they want to get him some games. I mean, Jonah Gajewicz sounds like he's made a couple of strides this year in Utica. Will Lockwood, I think, has played relatively well. You brought up Lucas Jasik. I think he's another guy that I would like to see, you know, maybe get some minutes. And yeah, it's going to be interesting. With Petey, just going, touching on that, I agree. Like, I don't think there's any rush to get him. I think Benning said today in his presser that Petey was going to be seeing a specialist in a day or two here. So I would assume if he's seeing a specialist and he's been out as long as he has, let's just shut it down. There's no point in getting him back in unless he is 100% fit to play. But, you know, we saw this with Brock Besser for the better course of 2 years, where he had that wrist injury and he always had his wrist taped up. You know, just let him rest, let him heal properly, and then he'll come into next season 100%. We don't need to rush Petey by any stretch here.
Yeah, one thing with Oli, he hasn't played since February 23rd. I'm all for DiPietro getting a game or two in if he can. I'm not exactly sure how that would all work, but I'm sure that there's a way they could get him in. But I think there's a good shot of that. Let's let the kids play. Speaking of kids playing, Vasily Podkolzin really put up a hell of a showing over in the KHL playoffs. That season ended for him today, but man, Podkolzin, I've been saying it for a while. I'm really excited to see this guy in Vancouver next year.
I am too. So here's a question for you, Pete, because if Podkolzin signs now and he comes and plays some games here, I think even if he just signs his professional contract with the Canucks now, I think it burns a year of his ECL. Do you wait till the season's over and then sign him? Or do you burn a year and just get him over here now, get him to play a handful of games?
Well, he wouldn't really be able to play any games. There's no reason to. His contract is valid until April 30th. So unless St. Petersburg releases him early or lets him talk to the Canucks early, the Canucks aren't able to sign him until the end of the month. And then he's got a quarantine coming over, which would take him up to about, you know, the 7th or the 8th. Let's just say the 7th. After the 7th, there's only 6 games left, and he wouldn't have had any practices. So really, it's probably only 5 or 4 games left. It's not worth it. And plus, it also depends if Russia wants to use him on their World Cup team as well. So for me, I just don't really see it being feasible for him to come over. I would wait until next year. There's no point in burning it this year.
I agree. I 100% agree. I know he's a shiny new toy, and he played incredibly well in the playoffs for St. Petersburg. I believe he put up nearly the same amount of points he did for the entire season, playing 68 games as he played, I believe it was in 21 games or for St. Petersburg.
He put up 11 points in 16 games in the playoffs, 11 points in 35 games in the regular season. But what was different in the playoffs is he was getting used a lot more. He had that triple overtime winner, and the coaches were letting him play a lot more. It's still a bit of a up and down with his games, but he really came into his own. Tied a few KHL records along the way as well for under-20s in the playoffs.
Yeah, I thought he was unbelievable over there. And, you know, shout out to friends of the show, Chris Faber and Fan2 Abby, for all the Podkolzin highlights and game times that Podkolzin's playing and all that stuff and post-game write-ups. You know, they kind of keep the majority of Canucks fans on Twitter informed about what's going on with some of the overseas prospects. So shout out to those two guys. But yeah, I agree. I would not be signing Podkolzin until the offseason and then get him over here into training camp and see where, you know, all the pieces fall. And, you know, like you said, him, Hoglander, maybe a guy like Cole Lind, you know, you do have some young wingers that hopefully can make an impact on the team next year. Jimmy Vesey's a guy that, you know, I do have some interest in as far as, you know, what he could maybe give you next year on a short, cheap deal. But yeah, who knows?
Couple other signings that feel like a lifetime ago now. Well, at least the Thatcher Demko one does. The Tanner Pearson one is still pretty fresh. For me, I'm a big fan of the Demko deal. I think that's a decent price for a goalie of his caliber. I don't like overpaying for goalies, and I shouldn't say overpaying, but I don't like spending more than about $6 million on a goalie, a starting goalie. I think that's too much, and I think the value that you're going to get out of Demko at 5x5 is excellent. Pearson deal, again, I like Pearson as the player, but this was way above what I would have signed him for. I was fine with keeping Pearson if the number was closer to $2 million per year, but going above 3 for me was right out of the question. 2.5 was even going to be kind of high. I like Pearson. I think he's a very useful player. I don't think he's necessarily declined as much as some people and some metrics will say, but he will decline as he gets older. That deal, it does seem like a strange one to me, and again, kind of happened very quickly. And again, a lot of people pointing fingers back at Francesco. There's been a lot of finger pointing at Francesco lately, but I know you said that the Canucks have a tendency to overpay and sell guys when they're low. For me, they have a way of saying things and then not kind of enforcing what they're saying. And that's why I think this Tanner Pearson thing comes in there. He's 29. It's a 3-year deal. Okay, that's not too bad. But I mean, was there really a rush to do it now? If you had, if you knew you weren't going to trade him at the deadline, why? What was the rush to sign him like that? And you hear his agent saying, "Oh, he probably would have gotten more on the open market." And it's like, well, yeah, that's your job to say that. So for me, it's one win with the Demko signing. I like that 5x5. I got no issues with that because I do believe that Demko is entering his prime and he still has another level to go, so I'm cool with that one. The Pearson one, again, that's a bit of a head scratcher for me. I think it's a bit of cap mismanagement on the Canucks' end.
Yeah, again, I like the Demko signing. I think, you know, it's good term. I think the dollar amount is good. Obviously, goalies are weird, right? They're really finicky. Goaltending isn't what it used to be. Like in the 90s, to me, that was like the heyday of goaltending, right? And now it's just like you get these guys kind of coming out of nowhere. One year they're on top of the world, and then the next year they literally just fall off a cliff. You know, I look at a guy like Tristan Jarry in Pittsburgh. You know, Jordan Binnington in St. Louis has struggled this year. It's just goaltending is just not what it used to be. I do think Demko is one of the better young goals. Carter Hart this year is struggling mightily in Philly. So yeah, I do think, you know, this is a good deal. I don't think it's an overpayment. They did pay for, I believe, two of his UFA years coming up. If you look at like the top goalies paid in the league, he's kind of right in the, I think, 12th or 11th overall, which is kind of middle of the row for starting goalies, which I don't think is bad. I think that makes a lot of sense. The Tanner Pearson thing, again, I agree, man. It just doesn't make sense. So here's the thing I get, okay? We heard Benning with the outbreak, and I understand that he wasn't going to ask certain players that were going through the COVID situation, although I guess Pearson never did end up on COVID protocol because he was injured. But you hear these things, you know, I don't want to move families during the pandemic and all that stuff. You know what? That's all fine. I get that. But then you think that, okay, you know what? If you're showing the player loyalty and you're saying, hey, you know what, man? I understand, you know, you got a young family. I don't want to have to trade you across the country or down south, you know. We won't trade you. We're going to re-sign you. You think there would be some kind of like give and take where the player's like, hey, I really appreciate you not trading me and moving my family across the country or, you know, across the border. So you know what? I'll take a bit of a discount. I'll take a $2.5 million contract for 3 years or whatever it's going to be. But that's not the case. We paid him what a lot of pundits thought he would have gotten probably in the open market, if not less. You know, a lot of people thought he would be getting a lot less than that in the open market. So that's what I don't understand. As you see Benning and he talks about, you know, trying to build this culture and, you know, being good and honest and loyal to his players, and yet he always overpays. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense. It's not like he doesn't, there's no benefit to him to doing this. And you know what? Maybe this is the Patriots fan in me and, you know, ruthless Bill Belichick. And shout out to Julian Edelman, retired today. I think he's a Hall of Famer, but that's a discussion for another day. Anyways, I don't understand what being this nice guy to all the players, and then you're never getting anything in return. They're not giving you a discount. You're still giving them no trade clauses. Right? Like Pearson has no movement clause and then a no trade clause. And I believe in the final year of the contract, he doesn't have any no trade clause. It's like, why? Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you need to, it's a business and you need to run it like a business. And again, I do think Pearson is a good player. It's nothing against him personally. But again, it's just Benning negotiating against himself, trying to be the super loyal guy to his players, and then he gets nothing back. He's literally given the players and the agents exactly what they ask for. There's no bargaining whatsoever, and it's a head-scratcher. And I honestly think it's a year too long. I know a lot of people are saying, oh, I'm okay with the term, but I don't like the dollar amount. You know what? I think 3 years is too long for this guy. I really do. I would have done a two-year deal. I might have been able to swallow it at that dollar amount if it was only a two-year deal, but this is looking like it's going to be another Russell deal or another Beagle deal where that final year of this contract, you're going to be like, man, this is dead weight.
It's a tough one. You said a benefit of it all. And I was thinking, oh, a Benning fit. That's more what it is, is a Benning fit. I feel like that I mean, we're running out of time, but this is where you need a hockey president. You need someone else in there, I believe, as a buffer between the manager and the owner, because we know they said they talk every day. This deal, it's a full no trade next year. Okay, I mean, if you're not trading him now, you're not going to trade him next year. The no trade for the year after that, it's a 7-team no trade list, so that's okay. So you can still move him to 3/4 of the league, and then it's wide open the year after that. But by that point, Is a team going to want to take the guy? I know his base salary is a little bit lower with the way they work it in, but still, it'll. I don't want to, you know, be talking about trading a guy when we've just signed him, but it's a weird one. If Pearson can kind of, if there's a more stable six wingers in the organization, maybe we're going to be getting more out of him. But it does feel like the Canucks are bargaining against the Canucks on this one. The timing of it again is strange, and this is a thing with the Canucks too, is they don't always explain what they're doing very well, or they say one thing and do another, and that's why you have a lot of frustrated fans in this market. I'm not a Benning fan. I'm not a Benning lover. I just do feel that it's time for a management change with the organization, but I don't think we're going to see that. I think from a lot of reports saying that it sounds more likely that Green and Clark won't be back next year, and that it's going to be Benning who has another year, and he is under contract. So, I mean, there could be a lot of hair pulling being done by Canucks fans over the next little while, because it does feel like the Fire Benning crowd is certainly growing and adding more people into the mix.
Yeah, I remember there was a couple of guys when we first started this podcast that were Benning truthers, and they, you know, they were big supporters of the club and some of the decisions they've made. And I would say in the past like 4 months or so, they've definitely flipped the script there. I'm the same. Like, you know what? Like, I do want to give Benning some credit. I do think he has done a good job drafting at times. But that's the other thing. It's like, it's the one thing he's been really good at, and yet he fails to add picks. And I'm sick and tired of the excuses. Oh, it's so hard to add picks in a salary cap. Every other team is doing it. Every other team is being able to add picks. You know what I mean? So, like, that's such a goddamn cop-out. And I think the other thing, too, is, like, I don't think fans are willing to give this management group the benefit of the doubt, right? And I think it's just they've been burned too many times with these contracts that have gone on for a year too long and $1 million too much that, you know, they're no longer willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. Do I think Pearson can still be a serviceable player for the majority of this contract and not fall off a cliff like Louis Erickson did? Absolutely. But again, I don't understand what, like you said, Pete, I don't see what the need was to sign this contract now. There was no point. Like, there was no reason to sign this contract now. And you know what? Like, why not make one of those backhanded deals where you flip him at the deadline, get an asset back, and then you sign him in the offseason? Like, you know, and again, if the Canucks would have signed Pearson in the offseason for the exact same deal they signed him to now, but flipped him today at the deadline for an asset, I would have been completely okay with that. Because then that, to me, shows that the Canucks had a bit of foresight and they said, okay, look, we are going to trade you. However, we will overpay you and give you an extra year on term in the offseason by, you know, trading you, and you know, if you resign with us. And I think that would have been totally reasonable for most Canucks fans. But no, instead, they keep him, they sign him, in my opinion, for a year too long and probably $1 million too much.
Yeah, I always like the trade a guy and re-sign him thing, but it doesn't happen a lot. That's my only kind of caution with that. About acquiring picks, I always use the Montreal Canadiens as an example. Marc Bergevin's a GM I really respect. I like what he does. He acquires picks and uses them as currency when he needs it. The past three draft, the Habs have had at least 8 picks, and there's only 7 rounds in the draft. This year, they're holding on to 11 picks, even after trading picks away. So you can get picks, but you have to have things that people want as well, and that's kind of the thing with the Canucks right now. You have your prospects that you don't want to move, you have your elite prospect like Pod Colson, and then you got a bunch of guys that make it pretty tough to move. I mean, they got a 6th for Jordy Benn today, so it kind of shows you that you got to have the right amount of assets as well. Well, Doug, should we break this down a bit and go into the free pour?
Let's do it. It's that time of the episode. It's the free pour open floor segment, and I'm just going to jump into mine, and I need to talk about a documentary I watched called Tina. It's the Tina Turner documentary done by HBO. I believe you can watch it on Crave. I cannot recommend it enough. Tina Turner, man, like, that woman's story and her legacy in rock and roll. She's the queen of rock and roll, man. And for her to have the second act that she did in the 80s, being a woman in her 40s, coming out of a really bad abusive relationship with Ike. It's an incredible documentary. It goes from the very beginning, her humble beginnings, obviously the tumultuous relationship that her and Ike Turner had, although they did and were able to create some incredible music together, and then her renaissance in the early to mid 80s and taking over the world again. And just, I cannot recommend this documentary enough to you, Pete, man. Tina, it's on Netflix, or pardon me, it's on Crave. It was done by HBO. Incredible documentary, an incredible woman who deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I don't have Crave, but if I did, I would check that out. I like Tina Turner as well. For me, I'm just going to talk a little bit about something that I think a lot of Vancouverites maybe take for granted. That's the city's bike network. We have an incredible array of ways to get around town, but one thing that they've done with investing in bike lanes, and where I really wanted to touch on with this, is they don't put a lot of the bike lanes on major streets. And this is something I've seen in other cities when they say we're doing bike lanes, is they'll put a segregated bike lane, or not even a segregated one, but they'll put them on major streets. And what Vancouver has done with making the non-major thoroughfares the bike lanes has really just revolutionized how I get around. I've been doing a lot of biking the last little while, again, as the weather gets better. And I always think that when I go down like Ontario or Heather or Adenac or some of these streets, I'm like, man, like, these are just beautiful streets. And it gives you a whole other network of the city. Also, I like how the way that they've labeled them, when it's its own sub network of bike lanes on top of the road network. So even if one like Heather moves off of Heather for a couple blocks, or Adnac moves off when it to Union, it keeps the same name. So as a cyclist, it makes it really easy to get around. You know, I've covered a lot of ground in the last little while. I love it. I think it's something that, you know, comparing to other cities that I biked in, take it for granted a bit, but the weather's getting good, folks. Go out there and ride your bicycle. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Episode 70, the Tanner Pearson episode. How about that? It's just about in the books. Lots to go over without any games. It's been an eventful week, and it's going to be an eventful week coming up as well, eh, Doug?
Yeah, the Canucks are slated to start playing games again. I believe it's Friday, isn't it?
Yep, it's Friday.
So, you know, that'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how many players still remain on COVID protocol, and how many players will actually be able to suit up. You know, I feel like we were making up for lost time on this episode, having been off the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I think we were both a little bit passionate with our fandom of this team. And, you know, we both expressed our disappointment with some of the decisions that have been made over the past year and today with the Canucks. But no matter what, you know, I will always cheer for this team. I will still watch the games, like you said, Pete. And I can't say I'm looking forward to this condensed schedule, but it will be nice to see Canucks hockey back on the old TV screens.
It's going to be a memorable end to the season regardless, so we'll give it that, but I think it's going to be hard-pressed for the Canucks to win a lot of games down the stretch here. So again, that'll probably lead some of my research more into what will also be a very weird draft to go along with a very weird season. You can follow me on Twitter at Pete_Gass. You can also check out our Canucks Speakeasy outro playlist. That is on Spotify. This jam's getting added to it as well. So give that a listen.
Give me a follow on Twitter at Doug Venn. And you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Canuck Speak. As always, thanks for listening.
Hasta luego.